Welcome to The Rink, your weekly source for hockey talk without the entitlement. I'm James Tapeleg Grayley, and along with Tom Luongo. This week, we're getting on the goalie go-around. We're going to talk about the old men returning to the NHL. And I've got a few ideas for a few rule changes. You may not like them. All of that, plus we're going to talk about NHL money. No, we do not have any money for you. That's all coming up next on The Rink. It isn't enough of a problem in the NHL these days for me that I can't even figure out who's going to be in goal for my team that I follow. But this past week has had this goalie go-around that's been insane. And it all seems to be tied together and all seems to link together. But it started out with the New York Islanders trying to sign Wade Dubowitz and only to lose him on waivers to the Columbus Blue Jackets, which I thought was absolutely hilarious.
Was that he was picked up on reentry waivers when they tried to re-sign him and bring him back up from the minors?
Actually, he was Dubowitz was bought out from his KHL contract and was basically sitting on a couch, and the Islanders needed him and so signed him. And then had, because it was the midseason signing, the free agent, blah blah blah, they had to put him on waivers. I don't know why Matt Sundin didn't have to go through waivers, but
no,
okay.
I think the fact that he was still must have still been in some way a property of the Islanders.
Maybe
and
he was
got claimed
to.
On reentry waivers by Columbus.
Now the funny part about that, of course, is that who has a higher priority standing in the waivers wire would be the Islanders because they're the worst team in the league. But they couldn't claim their own guy off their own waivers. Still, it's kind of amusing that that happened. And the poor, you know, of course, today. It's announced that Rick DiPietro is done for the season after playing only five games.
Which is, of course, why the Islanders tried to bring Dubowitz back from Russia.
Exactly. And why did the Blue Jackets need Dubowitz? Well, Pascal Leclerc, it's announced, is getting surgery on his ankle.
So they need a backup goaltender for Steve Mason.
Yeah, who's playing phenomenally.
It's definitely Calder material at this point.
And that's kind of that's its own weird little strange love triangle of goalies. And then on top of that, the Edmonton Oilers trade Matthew Garon to the Pittsburgh Penguins for Danny Sabourin, a pick and a player. And then immediately the Oilers place Danny Sabourin on waivers. it's ridiculous.
Well, it is really funny, but I mean they had three goalies out in Edmonton, so Garon wasn't playing anyway. And I think the thinking in Pittsburgh was that they wanted someone to really push Marc-Andre Fleury, and I think it's felt that Garon is a slightly higher quality goaltender than Sabourin is. And but considering what happened with Ty Conklin last year, is that pushing Fleury and Therrien riding him really hard while Fleury was injured was really good for the Pens. But Garon is one of those guys that's classically potentially streaky, brilliant Quebec goaltenders that can that could play like Yoann Zvezina.
Yeah,
and
at times,
right?
Yeah, and apparently the Oilers agree with you on Sabourin by your assessment of him by placing him right away on waivers. It's funny because you look at the LA Kings a couple of years ago, who had Matthew Garon and Jason LaBarbera, and it was this is going to be chancy, but it could really pay off, and it looks great. And now Garon went to Edmonton, he was all right there, and now he's in Pittsburgh as a backup, and LaBarbera's been moved, so it's. The franchise goaltender from the minor leagues is getting kind of elusive these days.
Right. You're right. This was kind of funny how it all seems to have worked out in the end.
On top of that, Roberto Luongo returns to net, and is not looking so hot right now. He got the team to the shootout and lost in the shootout in spectacular fashion. Mm-hmm. In their last 10 games, the Canucks are 2-5-3, and I do believe those two came before Sundin came in. So
right, and I but apparently Luongo gave up a goal in his first shot back.
Yeah.
I think it was. Actually, Don Cherry made a good point about that the other night on HNIC. He said that they made a mistake in putting Luongo back in on a home game. What they should have done was just, you know, played their last game at home and then slip him in on the road where he wouldn't have any pressure. We wouldn't have the big crowd and the whole thing with him coming back with Sundin and all of that stuff. You play him on a road game where he can get his feet back underneath him and get back into a groove, and then you bring him back to the hometown crowd and let him handle it from there. But that's, you know, I'm not sure I completely agree with it, but it is an interesting take on how a coach could have handled it.
Yeah, no, it's like I would kind of think get your nerves back in with a, you know, a command performance by him would have really kind of set him and the team up for, you know, a good streak coming down the road. But considering that essentially, I mean, they got a point out of it. In a way, you can consider it a moral victory, but it's not really. Yeah, not considering the talent they're supposed to have, not considering, you know, that they've severely upgraded up front with Sundin, you know, but. They should be doing better than that. Now, mind you, they are in seventh place right now. That's a playoff position. You know, they're doing better there than a couple other teams in the Northwest.
And they are, you know, yeah, they aren't solidly in a playoff position. But if they don't, you know, get their act together quickly after the All Star break, they're going to be in serious trouble. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, Minnesota and Edmonton are playing reasonably well. They're 1 point behind them and scratching out someone's, you know, scratching right at their door for the number seven, number eight spot. This five teams separated by 2 points in the West. Anaheim, Phoenix at 51, Vancouver at 50, Minnesota, Edmonton at 49. And of those five teams, it's Anaheim and Vancouver that have played the worst hockey over the last 10 games. Mm-hmm. Anaheim is 4-5-1, Vancouver's 2-5-3. And everybody else is over five, is playing, you know, 600 hockey, basically. 6-3, 6-3-1, 6-4, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you know. No, I agree with you. It's not it's anybody's game for the last ones right now. It's just with all the goalie craziness that's going on right now. It's just an interesting landscape to be looking at.
Right.
Yeah. That's just kind of my take on it. Also looking around the league at some other interesting player developments, I guess you could say. The old boys are back. Brendan Shanahan gets a goal in his first 2 minutes of his first game back this season with the Devils and had 6 shots on goal to lead the Devils in shots for that night.
Well, you know, he's going to have enough energy to play, you know, a good 5 to 10 really good games before his old legs, you know, give out on him. And he's back to the same form he was in when he was playing for the Rangers, where he was a complete liability 5-on-5 and really only play on the power play. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I give Shanny credit for wanting to come back and wanting to play. He's a consummate professional and a competitor and all that. But I'm not convinced that he's going to put the Devils over the top or anything. I may eat my words on this, but I just don't see it. And then we've got Chani, and then the San Jose Sharks finally pulled the trigger on bringing Claude Lemieux up from the minors. So he's 43 years old and going to add a little bit more sandpaper and playoff experience to a Sharks team that has actually, you know, faltered in that department in the past. So. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, Claude Lemieux knows how to win playoff games, and that's, you know,
and win them against the Red Wings.
Yeah, which is where they really need him. He is not, you know, yeah, like you say, he's 43. I mean, it was a strange signing. It was a strange, you know, path. Anyways, he started in was it China or Japan?
I don't know.
Affiliate there, and then kind of moved over here. And all this has been pretty quick from sitting on your couch to 6 months later after you decided to be in the NHL. That's pretty fast. Who needs a youth movement with these guys? You know.
Well, yeah, and now you see Chicago. Today, though, looking at Forsberg wants to come back yet again.
Yeah.
And Colorado's, you know, right on the bubble of being able to push into a playoff position if they showed any kind of.
I don't think the Colorado Avalanche necessarily need Forsberg, especially considering his streak as he has been. I think that the Denver Post needs Peter Forsberg to play. Their popularity goes up quite a bit whenever his name is mentioned.
Well, yeah, there is always that, but I'm not. I'm just looking at the standings and everything else. If Colorado were to go on a good solid 7-3 streak, they would be, you know, they'd be right in it.
Absolutely.
Right in it for a hunt for the number 8 seed. So further putting pressure on, you know, the Sundin and Luongo and company in Vancouver.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, just looking at the standings again, every team in that is not in a playoff position right now has more goals against than goals for. So that really is taking its toll with the Avs, with other teams right now. You can't just score them in bunches. You got to be able to score them in a consistent manner.
And you've got to be able to win the special teams battles. When you look at Edmonton and Colorado and Dallas and the other teams that are on the bubble and the play and that kind of position, you're looking at lower half of the league power play and abysmal penalty mm-hmm. killing. 77% is not going to get it done. 76% is not going to get it done. Especially if you are a bubble team, you have to distinguish yourself in some way in order to win, in order to claw those points out, and the extra half a goal a game that you can get out of your special teams is usually that's your distinction. If you look in the East, you'll see exactly you'll see that same scenario playing itself out, that of the teams that are on the bubble. The one with the best special teams are my Buffalo Sabres, and nearly a 20% power play and top three in the league in penalty killing. Mm-hmm. And so they're good on the road, and as opposed to Florida, whose penalty killing isn't bad, but their power play is average, and so is Pittsburgh's, and Pittsburgh's penalty kill isn't very good. So by that theory, eventually special teams will. Gaining points, and you look recently at the surge the Sabres have put on. It's been getting to overtime and then winning in the shootout, and it's been usually a special teams goal here or there that's able to get them there, either a late penalty kill or a late power play or whatever, and that's what's gotten them a point here or a point there.
Like I say, we came home the other night to turn on NHL Network, and. And by the way, I dissed the NHL Network schedule before on my blog, but before I actually had it, and now that I have it, I want it all the time.
The NHL Network is great. It's really good.
We get home to watch highlights, and I can't remember who the Sabres were playing, and I hear and it's a Sabres highlight, and I hear from the other room, "Don't just stand there, don't just watch him." Ah! And somebody scored on the Sabres. I thought you'd appreciate that. in an angry kind of way.
they might have had a microphone hidden in my house somewhere. It might have been me.
You certainly have an agreeer in this household. Not to stick the knife in and twist or anything, but sure. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this whole knocking the puck in with a high stick. This just seems like this season's skating the crease. I mean, we're looking at how many times have we had replays of high sticks where the TV cameras have gotten it correct and the war room hasn't. The rule basically being that you can't knock a puck in the net with a stick that's over the crossbar, 4 feet or higher.
Yeah. Just 4 feet off the ground. And the guys involved are not midgets.
No.
So David Backes, and in the two that we've had, the two most controversial so far, which is the we're referencing now, David Backes' goal the other day against Boston in the last 2 seconds mm-hmm. to get to overtime, and then they won it, and then they won it either in overtime or the shootout or whatever, and then obviously for me the Sidney Crosby goal where somehow he's many things, Sidney Crosby, and he's very good at hockey, but I did not know he could transform himself into a 4'8" midget.
His stick could be that high up.
The only way a stick could be parallel with his collarbone
and still be legal,
and him on his tiptoes. Okay, for him to be under the for his collarbone to be lower than the crossbar, he'd have to be a 4'8" midget.
Yeah,
and he's not. I mean, he's very good at hockey. And he's a very, very talented man. I just didn't think he was capable of
shrinking
transformation. I didn't think it was the physical transformation thing.
I'm just tired of these rules that are getting reviewed, and getting review should be there to correct a mistake, but instead what winds up happening is creating even more controversy. We don't have it in baseball. In football, the person who made the call, basically the on-field referee, if he's challenged, he's the one who has to make the next who has to make the decision. So he actually incorporates what he saw with the replay footage and be able to make the right call. I'm sick to death of this. I'm ready for the rule to be changed. Anything is a goal. If the puck goes in, it's a goal. If you can kick it in, if you can knock it down with a high stick, if you had a gun that shot pucks at the net and it went in, it could go in. I say that you give the coach, I say that you give each coach one puck, and they either get a puck or a timeout. And as soon as a goal is or a penalty is called against them and the goalie comes out of the crease, the opposing team, they can throw that puck, and if they make it in the net, that's a goal. I say that you give a puck to a fan in the 100 section, in the lower bowl, in the third period, and if they can make it in, it's a goal. I don't care if they do it in the warm-ups. It's got to be a goal. If the puck goes in, it's got to be a goal. I'm sick to death of everything being reviewed. Not bad camera angles. It doesn't add to the drama. It doesn't add to the excitement of the game. I am over it. It's all a goal.
You know, and it's funny. Wow. And Wyshynski and the shootout distractors would turn to you and say, we already decide games on, you know, effectively the same thing as the coach trying to fling a puck into the net from the behind the bench. So it's really, you know, pretty much the same thing. So
at least it'd be a team game. It'd be a total team game. I'm telling you.
It'd be a total team game.
You get a couple of good pitchers from baseball, and all of a sudden you'll have new assistant coaches. They won't know anything about hockey, but they can pitch. And they can throw that sucker in there.
But they're not your timeout specialist or your delayed penalty specialist.
Yeah, if Joel Quenneville doesn't have a very good forearm throw, then the goalie's coming out of the net. But you know, if Jacques Lemaire actually has a pretty good toss, you may actually keep a goalie in for a delayed penalty.
No one's Claude Lemaire, Jacques Lemaire, and his desire to win hockey games in any way, manner, shape, or form, no matter how boring, ugly, or insipid. I'm sure that he would practice throwing pucks at the net 12 hours a day in order to take advantage of that little rule. So,
I think that this is something that the GMs have to actually talk about is how the rule could be. And here's another thought, man. Maybe you have the you cannot knock one in any higher than the shoulders of the shortest person on the ice right then. Which just means that, you know, Martin St. Louis is going to start killing penalties.
Right, which means that the Sabres have a tremendous advantage over everybody else because we get Nathan Gerby in at 5'4", and that's it.
And your next old guy that's going to get recalled to the NHL is going to be Darren Pang. You know? And just it's the short guys league.
Well, you know, I think that for the most part, I do agree that we have really gone overboard and trying to legislate what is and is not a good goal or a hockey goal. Same thing, we're trying to legislate what is a good and not good or hockey hit.
Right.
And all of these things, you know, at the end of the day, and it's something that you and I've discussed ad nauseum off camera or off air about whether or not the rule and whether or not the concept of the rule itself can actually create, can you legislate in the drama and fairness and all of these things, and can the rules, in fact, save you from these problems? And, you know, my argument has always been that, no, they really can't. But in the case of something like this, I think, you know, other than the most egregious things, like shooting the puck intentionally 10 feet in the air for a guy to deflect it from, you know, over his head and into the net.
Right.
You know, because guys would practice that. You know, they would. Because they don't want the sticks getting up in the air and that kind of thing. What I would say at the end of the day is that, you know, as long as the stick's not above the guy's head, I don't really care.
Yeah,
the crossbar rule is really very arbitrary.
Yeah.
And in my mind, you just liberalize the entire thing by saying, look, if it's higher than his head, which we should be able to figure out pretty easily.
Right.
And if it's close, who gives a shit? You know, who cares?
I think that you're right about that, in that it is arbitrary for the, you know, for the crossbar. But I think that what they were trying to do was say, okay, here's a definitive thing. It's 4 feet high. Right. It's the crossbar. It's a definitive thing. And then they don't have the systems to actually make it a succinct review. You know,
you don't have the infrastructure to enforce that rule. Then,
no, absolutely.
I mean, that rule in place is idiotic.
If ESPN or other baseball televisors can show me whether a pitch right after it happens in a graphic detail was actually a strike or not in a little box with a graphic, if Fox can put a freaking blue-green streak thing when it goes over a certain, you know, on the puck, which nobody wants to see come back, we can't tell if a puck has actually crossed the line or not. That seems like a joke.
It has gotten that bad, and the parallax that they've got with putting cameras on the net and all of these things. At the end of the day, it just looks really unprofessional.
Yeah. I mean, I wish it added to the game, but it really doesn't at this point, and something needs to be done. It's something I think that the GMs need to talk about.
Yeah, at the end of the day, I mean, I would prefer them to be talking about that than to be talking about whether or not they should get rid of fighting.
Well, yeah, that's supposedly the next thing on the docket for them.
Right.
Which, obviously, I mean, it's obvious why everybody's talking about fighting, is that a player finally, and everybody knew it was going to happen eventually, was killed. Died due to an injury suffered on the ice because of a fight.
Right.
And it's tragic and it's horrible and it has to be talked about. But for the NHL GMs, I don't think that you're going to see anything but lip service paid to that sort of issue.
No, I don't think so. I think actually if anything does come out of it, well, I think what I've heard from various people on this is that what they would really like to get away from, and where the real complaints from within the league, from some coaches and whatnot, is the slew footing that goes on during a fight.
Mm-hmm.
Is a guy slew footing the other guy to get him off his feet and then get him onto the ground. And that's become pretty commonplace. And that needs to go.
Yeah.
I'm all about letting these guys fight and, you know, get their aggressions out and get their frustrations out and do whatever they feel they need to do. And in effect, you know, the whole concept of the code and self-policing and all of that stuff. At the end of the day, slew footing under any circumstance is extremely dangerous. I don't like it when it happens, you know, when they're in the corners. I don't like it when I see, you know, I see it in the neutral zone. I don't want to see it during a fight. If you can't stand up and throw punches, you know, with a guy,
then
you
shouldn't
be there. Then turtle and take the shame and be done with it.
Yeah.
And just get out of there. But don't slew foot him and then, you know, potentially break a guy's skull open on the ice. That's just no.
Well, and Brian Burke's in the league still, so there is still going to be fighting, of course. I mean, there's no way in hell he's going to say
his comment. I think I saw something. It was either at Kukla's or at Puck Daddy about this issue. And they had a big long blurb about from Brian Burke saying it's a very important part of the game and the self-policing and blah 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 and all of those hitting all those high points. I don't think that's I don't think it's going anywhere.
Right. Well, I don't think it's going anywhere either. It's I think the most interesting development that we've seen is that Canadian Hockey League, the Junior League, now says that they have to keep their helmets on if they're going to fight. Is that correct?
I don't know. I didn't hear anything about that. I'm sorry.
There's all sorts of rules being bandied about whether you keep your helmet on, whether you don't, a visor. If you have a visor, you should take your helmet off, blah, blah, blah. You know, I think that fighting is just part of the game, and it's one of those hard things that, you know, this isn't boxing. You're not going to say this is legal, that isn't. It's a fight. It's a fight.
Yeah. It's two guys that really don't like each other at that moment in time, and they're going to go and they're going to throw at each other. And yeah, the etiquette is that if you're wearing a visor, you get rid of your helmet because, you know, the guy shouldn't have to punch plastic.
Right.
And that's, I think that etiquette is fine. But if that's the case, then don't slew foot him. Just punch him in the nose and be done with it.
Well, the GMs are going to talk about it. The last order of business that I know of that is big for the league right now has to deal with the CBA and escrow payments. And also, of course, that there's still talk about whether or not nobody's really said yes, they will, no, they won't. As far as I know, the NHLPA wanting to reopen the salary cap. But the interesting part, of course, is that they're saying now that escrow payments are probably going to be kept this year by the league and possibly even be higher than the 13% that originally gets taken out.
Yeah, they had set escrow at 13%. Paul Kelly was on between games on Hockey Night in Canada this weekend. There was a really good interview conducted by Ron McLean, and the first thing Ron McLean cornered him on was, are escrow payments going up, and are they going to 17 to 20%? And Paul Kelly said, that sounds about right. Mm-hmm. So he confirmed on Canadian television that escrow is going up to between 17 and 20%, which means, of course, that the 13% that they've been taking out was not covering, was not going to cover the overage. This year, this season, players are due 56.5% of revenues, which tells me, which is the classic canary in a coal mine. I think Myrtle had a post up on this on Monday, and I had a short blurb up on it on Sunday night on Fan House, talking about the same thing. This is your proverbial canary in a coal mine about NHL revenues are not as rosy as their original projections. The last thing that the league said was that they were probably not going to see the 6 to 7% revenue rise over last season this year that they had projected. It's going to be down around 2%, and a lot of that loss comes from the shrink in the Canadian dollar from, you know, it averaged nearly 90 cents to the U.S. dollar last year, and today it closed at under 79 cents. And that's where most of the marginal increase in the salary cap has come past the first, I would say the first, these last two seasons. A lot of that has to do with expansion of Canadian revenues and the rise in the Canadian dollar on top of it. I think I figured out that about 25% of the total rise in the salary cap has come from just currency appreciation.
And this and the Canadian franchises are what the NHL has been staking not only their current financial situation on, but also they've been talking about expanding in Canada, and that's where the NHL should be looking. Even Paul Kelly was saying this in the past that we should be looking towards Canada for a few more franchises so that we can promote the health of the league, and now right. The dollar figure is going down. That's well, the two don't jibe.
Let's not conflate the two issues in a sense that there's nothing wrong with the strength of the Canadian hockey business. It's right. Extremely strong. It just doesn't translate to total of revenues as expressed in U.S. dollars as well as it did last year. But it's still very strong, meaning you can still pack a Canadian arena full of rabid Canadians wanting to watch professional hockey. That's not the issue. The issue is, the side issue is that whether or not it's going to adversely affect the salary cap and have the GMs overplayed their hands in terms of what they signed these guys to. In my mind, the salary cap situation is only going to get worse. It may not be too bad this year. We may only see the cap stay flat or maybe slightly drop. I'm still betting for a small drop in the salary cap, even if it only drops $500,000 or so. Yeah. But it's the year after that when the corporate sponsors, who are the major source of the league's revenue for this year, why revenues aren't going to be horrible because of the shrinking U.S. economy. This year, it's not going to be too bad because a lot of their revenue for this year was booked preseason by corporate sponsorships and skyboxes being bought and all of that stuff. And what happens in 2009, 2010, when many of the companies who have naming rights for the arenas aren't going to even be in existence? Yeah. I mean, let's be realistic here. I mean, half of them are banks.
Yeah.
And many of these banks might not be in existence next year. So, what are you looking at? I could easily see a contraction of the salary cap by a couple of million dollars at a minimum for not for 2009-2010, but for 2010-2011, which would be the last year, the last option year of the CBA. And if that's the case, we're looking at another lockout or strike or whatever, because the two sides are not going to be agreeing in that, under those circumstances. The players are going to want some kind of concession, and they're going to want some kind of reorganization of the league. There's a lot of grumbling already about, you know, basically, you know, why should we in Calgary pay to support the Phoenix Coyotes?
Right. Which is the argument that we've heard before, but at the same time, to kind of turn that on its head, to go back a few years, it was questionable as to whether or not the Calgary Flames could re-sign Jerome Iginla pre-lockout because of the Canadian dollar was as weak as it was, and he would basically make more money at signing this exact same contract in a U.S. city. And so it's, you know, it's kind of funny.
Oh, yeah. No, it all comes full circle. You're absolutely right. And, you know, from my perspective, being the amateur economist that I am, I just find it really funny watching how the exchange rate and the and central bank policy has trickled down into all these little things. And we can actually put names and do we attach individual names to those who have been affected by the way by the machinations of various central banks, i.e. in this case, the U.S. Federal Reserve, and how Jerome Iginla and the people in Calgary were would have made much different decisions had the Canadian dollar been stronger throughout the early part of the century.
Well, you were mentioning naming rights and banks, and we do have a new president who is also a sports fan. So maybe they sign a naming rights bailout package. Every bank
bailing everybody else out.
Yeah, why not? You know, a certain dollar amount of everybody's bailout can go towards their naming rights of their arena that they have.
Yeah, it has to go to that in order to support the local economy. It'll be that kind of thing. I'm just waiting for Larry Flint to get his bailout money and then turn around and want to, you know, take control, move a team to Las Vegas and turn it into the, you know,
the Las Vegas
Hustlers. Yes,
I don't know. Hustler Arena in Columbus. That could be. He is from Cincinnati, just down the road, isn't he?
He is right. That's right. He could, you know. I could make something. I'm not going to say what.
I think you should. I think we should find a Photoshop genius and make a little graphic of Hustler Arena. I don't want to think about what the amenities or the team shop is going to look like. Actually, hang on. I do want to think about it. No, wait, I don't.
No, you can think about that all you want. But we're still
somewhere
trying to keep
else
the family
in
show
private.
Somewhere. Yeah, very private. Does Meg know about this?
Stop. Apparently does now. Are you kidding me? She hasn't listened to the podcast in weeks. She's just like, yeah, you go do what you need to do. You go talk about hockey with the boys. That's what.
But yeah, no. But seriously, the situation is much worse than anybody wants to let on. And I think the what's going to make or break the salary cap for this season is going to be the ability of teams and potentially in some of these really depressed markets to sell playoff tickets.
Yeah,
I mean, there's a good chance that the Phoenix Coyotes are going to make the playoffs this year.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that it's possible they don't sell out their home games?
I think it's absolute. I've been to a couple here in Phoenix. I've been staying here the last few weeks, and I've seen a. I saw the Blackhawks, arguably the most exciting team right now in hockey. I mean, the Red Wings are the Red Wings. The Sharks are very exciting right now, but the Blackhawks come to town right after the Winter Classic, and the attendance was abysmal. And I wound up taking pictures of it. I should put some on the rink of just empty seats after empty seats. And these are lower bowl seats where, you know, we're used to seeing a lot of empty seats anyways, you know, corporate sponsors, blah, blah, blah. But the attendance was absolutely abysmal for a game against the most, you know, one of the most exciting teams in the league. And, you know, mind you, they didn't miss much from the Coyotes. The Coyotes decided not to show up that night, and I believe it was either 6-1 or 6-0 game for the Blackhawks.
They certainly showed up the other night against Calgary, I say that, and they beat Calgary in their own barn up in the frozen tundra, and that was I watched part of that game, and they look good up there.
Yeah,
I can tell you that.
Well, you know, I mean, that's the problem with the Phoenix Coyotes and, of course, other teams in, you know, what people would say smaller or marginal markets is that, you know, their success on the ice is going to translate only so far if people hear about it. And around here, you know, you see an ad here, an ad there, but really they can put out as many promotions as they want for four tickets, four beers, and four hot dogs for $75, and they're not going to sell them because nobody knows about it.
Right.
And that's
same thing. It's the same problem in Florida. Mm-hmm. It's the same problem in Miami.
Yeah.
And they're trying the same thing. And that's a team that's very likely, I mean, at this point, Florida's balanced. And I can see them making the playoffs.
Absolutely. Florida doesn't realize that they're Florida. They just don't seem to realize that ever since 1996, their ability to play hockey has been revoked, and they seem to have forgotten that. Now they're playing well.
They're playing well now. The rebuild in Florida has finally started to bear fruit. They've got a great defense. They've got solid goaltending. And, you know, guys are starting to step up to the plate. And David Booth, Gregory Campbell, Nathan Horton, they're scoring goals. They're not great, but they're competent, and they're a classic bubble team at this point. And if they get hot, and Vokoun has the ability to win games all by himself, they get hot at the right time. It could be very interesting coming down the stretch.
I think it is going to be interesting.
And I do not want to be the Pittsburgh Penguins under those circumstances.
No.
Because they're on the outside looking in.
Yeah, absolutely. They're trading first and second right now. The only thing that's keeping that really has Florida in eighth and Penguins in ninth at the games in hand. And that's a good position to be in against the Penguins right now. And
absolutely.
A couple games ahead, you know, and you could really make a case that the Penguins are absolutely going to miss it. And thank goodness for the Steelers that are hopefully going to, you know, they're making the people of Pittsburgh forget their woes right now on the ice.
Mm. Yeah, well, it's the same thing. I mean, it was the rise of Arizona. Mm. We've got the Cardinals finally, after decades worth of ineptitude, going to make the Super Bowl, and you know, now we got the Coyotes might get back to the playoffs, and
yeah, it's kind of funny going out there to Glendale, and there's University of Phoenix Stadium, which you know, which already makes me scratch my head. A university has the naming rights for a professional arena, okay? And
well, the University of Phoenix is everywhere.
That's true.
They're like the Borg. They're like the Google of. Google of education.
I assimilated my BA in fine arts, and hopefully people are going to go to that football game, and they're going to look at the stadium, and they go, hey, what's that next door? Jobbing.com arena. What happens there? It's so funny because as you drive by the big Glendale complex of the big box bars and restaurants and the arenas and the like, you see the big silver University of Phoenix Stadium, and then you can't see jobbing.com arena. You can't even see it.
There's a naming right that is just going to go bye-bye. But if that's the best they've got,
What are they going to get?
They'd be better off just going back to calling Phoenix Municipal War Memorial Death and Decay Stadium. I mean,
I want to see iTunes Arena. That's what I want to see.
That'd be fine, you know.
Photoshop Stadium.
Better than jobbing.com, but just go whole hog and Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs Arena.
Steve Jobs. You know,
Steve Jobs has cancer arena.
Yeah. Just be nice. I want my iPods and all of that for the next several years.
I love Steve Jobs. He's a prick, that guy. I like him.
I think that the next, if anything, the Phoenix Coyotes should have their arena sponsored by the San Jose Sharks, because they can actually sell when they come, or the Detroit Red Wings. So the Coyotes could be playing at Red Wings Stadium, since people actually show up to the Red Wings games in Phoenix.
Joe Lewis South.
Yeah. Oh man, just painful.
Whatever. It's, you know, Southern Joe Lewis. Yeah.
Well, Tom, I think that's about the state of the state. Thanks a lot.
No problem, man. Anytime.
Thanks a lot for listening to The Rink. You can find my blog over at jerseysandhockeylove.com, and Tom's writing is over at nhl.fanhouse.com. You can always find The Rink at www.rinkpodcast.com, where you can also subscribe in iTunes or a few other podcast services. You can email us at rink@rinkpodcast.com or call us at 845-704-RINK. That's 845-704-7465. And again, thanks a lot for listening to The Rink.